Hello, colleagues, and welcome to the first monthly podcast for members of Forum Strategy. My name is Frank Norris, and I was the former CEO of the Culp Academies Trust and quite a senior HMI working for Ofsted on stuff like framework development and local authority inspections and stuff like that. I'm currently advising the Northern Powerhouse Partnership on Education and Skills Matters through a secondment from the co-op group, and I've been asked to chair these monthly chats that look back on some significant issues over the past 4 weeks, and also try to look forward to some important matters that may be coming along. I'll be joined each month by Sarah Jins, former Forum Strategy's research manager. Sarah's been with Forum Strategy for nearly 7 years, and prior to that was a policy manager at the National College for over 11 years. So between us, I think we've got a fair range of backgrounds and a sufficient experience to warrant this sort of discussion. So let's say hello to Sarah. Hello, Sarah. How are you?
Hello, Frank. Great, thank you. Good to be here.
How nervous are you?
A heady mixture of excited and terrified.
Like me, yeah. I'm sort of... I suppose my only anxiety is about making sure that we make it relevant and interesting for the members, you know. So it's always a challenge, but actually I hope that members will respond either positively or negatively, you know, to our chats today, so that we can make them even more relevant as we go forward. So is it worth having a few sort of ground rules then for these podcasts? I was thinking we've got to be forward thinking, and I think, you know, it's important to be positive in our outlook. That's my first one. What's yours?
Yes, I think so. And also, Frank, to acknowledge that everyone's experiencing still significant challenge in the system at the moment, that we won't be critical of any group or individual or minister. I think that well-known phrase or saying that's often misattributed is pertinent here. Be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a hard battle.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think also we've got to try and be topical and try and do things, explain things in a fairly clear and concise way. I know that's something I struggle with at times. So a challenge to you there, Sarah, if I start venturing off on an overlong response, please put me straight. So I was thinking, Sarah, I wonder where people are who are listening to this podcast. You know, I mean, it could be jogging, cycling, driving, relaxing somehow, perhaps a glass of wine or a soft drink, gardening. They might be at work, or they might even be in the shower, heaven help us. But before we start thinking too closely about where they might be, let's quickly move on. So, Sarah, you know, over to you.
Thanks, Frank.
What's so, going to happen, how we're going to play it?
Yes, I mean, I think the idea is that we'll each podcast will probably cover around six sort of current topical issues. We'll look back at probably about half of those, just covering important issues that have cropped up through the sort of scouring of that's been done for the briefings over recent weeks, and that are regularly circulated to members of the strategy intelligence briefing, and also the midweek briefings that we've now started to do as well. As well as that, we'll look at sort of things that are coming over the horizon at us, and thinking ahead to things that might be coming into play to try and help our CEO colleagues to get ahead of that, the curve in those sorts of ways. So we hope that you're going to find these chats helpful, and we're keen to hear your views, as Frank said earlier, on how we can make them even more useful to us. So please do be honest with your feedback.
So do you want to kick off then with the first issue?
Yes. I mean, obviously, something huge in the news at the moment has been the COP summit in Glasgow this sort of last week. We've been trying as Forum Strategy to raise more awareness about sort of environmental sustainability issues. One of our three CEO strategy groups that we developed during the course of the pandemic was focused on environmental sustainability, and we're going to continue that theme. We've been doing a lot of work, and we know that there are some trust leaders who are really at the forefront of the thinking on this. For the Academy Trust system, it's by no means widespread at the moment, but there are some really leading thinkers and it's not a very good word, actioners in the system at the moment. So the Secretary of State actually offered a keynote speech on this, where he did announce the new sustainability strategy. And he raised some interesting points. He's, you know, the fact that children are really at the forefront of the thinking, they need to be at the forefront of the thinking, and they want to take action, actually. So I think that this empowerment that's aimed through the strategy is, it could be hopefully really powerful. There was a suggestion of a new kind of Duke of Edinburgh type award for actions around climate. I am minded to mention, and if colleagues do have some time, to have a look at, probably sounds a strange reference, a BBC Country File from the 7th of November was all about Plant Britain. It featured Matt Baker talking to a six-year-old young environmentalist who was passionate about all this. And he had some of his classmates, and part of the COP event was for children to sort of make pledges to the earth, basically give messages to the earth. And if you get a chance to have a look at it, it's the Plant Britain episode on BBC iPlayer. It's about from about 31 minutes in to the recording. And just listen, there's a couple of children, six-year-olds, reading out their messages to the planet. And I suspect that many of you will be moved, as Matt Baker was, almost to tears by those messages. That the power of the thinking from children of 6 years old was incredible. In many senses, I think children are leading us on this. I think that hopefully that this new strategy will help to galvanise the thinking into the core curricula and actions of schools and trusts, rather than it sort of being at the periphery.
It's interesting we talk about young people, children having a voice in this area, but actually it sort of begs the question, why don't they have a stronger voice in loads of other areas? It's as if they're being enabled to have a voice here. But actually, I suppose, in a sense, the challenge for CEOs and senior leaders is to consider, why is it just in this area? And is there much more they can do to ensure that the voice of the child, the voice of the young person, plays more strongly into guiding their thinking? It's not determining their thinking, but it's helping assist in the way forward, not just around sustainability and issues like this. I think it does pose an interesting challenge, I think, for some colleagues in terms of, how open do they want to be to enable that voice to be heard?
Definitely. And I think it's often about channeling the sort of the interests and the passions, isn't it? And I think this is what so many schools, particularly primary schools, actually do so well. And also particularly in some very challenging areas, they kind of deliver the curriculum through topic-based curriculum, where they're drawing on sort of what are the local interests, what piques the interests of children in that area, and drawing in the core elements of the curriculum, so primary sort of maths, English and science, through the lens of those core interests and drawing on that. So I guess it's I suppose thinking of it in a similar approach, maybe. I'm no curriculum expert, but I think maybe that's the secret, really, that the children have got a vested interest in this area. They're passionate about it because it is ultimately, it's literally life and death for their future in many ways. That's their thinking, and they're raising their voices in response to that. And also, children and young people often have a very strong sense of social justice. And this is a real social justice issue for them as well, isn't it? And they're kind of stomping their feet, metaphorically and literally, on this.
It's interesting because the second point I wanted to make links into this. Quite neat, this, isn't it, when it flows this smoothly. But actually, I think I was, the work I do with the Northern Powers Partnership, it's a real privilege because it enables me to meet some sort of fairly senior business leaders, not just in the north, but across the country. And I think I'm always struck by how positive they are about what young people bring to their business, you know. And actually, I know that you hear a lot about, well, they haven't got this skill, or they're not good enough in that. I very rarely hear that, to be honest. But actually, the issue here was around, you know, how I suppose I was recalling a chat I had with a battery manufacturer in the Northeast, and he was saying that despite he wasn't sure that the curriculum was actually delivering the sort of skills and knowledge that his particular business would need, you know, his industry would need. And it sort of made me think about whether or not schools themselves really adapt fully to meet the needs, the growing needs, or the changing needs is probably the way to describe it, of a region's economy, you know, and to actually sort of take on board, you know, renewable energy and stuff like this, and actually embed it into the curriculum. So it was a sort of challenge, I suppose, to me as to whether or not there needed to be sort of a more radical review of the national curriculum. But even if there wasn't, there was still lots of space for schools to adapt their curriculum to meet the needs of their local community. So, you know, I think for me, this plays heavily into that action around climate, and that it doesn't just rest with the young people, but it actually needs to connect with those further down the line who hopefully will benefit from the work that teachers have done with young people and enable them to play a part in a local economy. You know, so it's about their futures as well.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that we've seen quite a lot recently. We've seen some reports from the World Economic Forum. We've seen some reports from McKinsey about the sort of skills that are going to be needed further down the line. I think there's a sort of discussion about obviously the renewable sector and the specific skills that may be needed there, but also the kind of move to, I mean, the thinking about the fact that manual skills are more likely to be replaced by sort of automation and AI. But actually, the demand for sort of technological skills and the social and higher cognitive skills is likely to increase. They're the sort of things that you can't replicate if you're not a human. Those sorts of I think McKinsey had come up with some sort of functional skills that would likely to lead to better employment and higher incomes because they're sort of they kind of exist around those more human behavioral skill sets
Yeah,
that
I
can't
agree.
be replicated. So things that, you know, as in terms of things that we've always known that children and young people will need to know or be able to do when they get into work, the world of work, but being able to not just work on your own, but work as part of a team, having those sort of collaborative skill sets, that sort of thing, be able to be agile as well in their thinking and their working and move swiftly between different ways of working to adapt to, you know, not just changes of economy, but day-to-day changes in the world of work. So I think all of these, and I think we also forget that whilst most academy trusts do still follow the national curriculum for obvious reasons, because that's what the exam boards set their questions to align with, so it'd be tricky to go too off-piste with those. But they do have the flexibility to think more locally. It's sort of along the lines of our 2019 conference, Frank, which you were there, talking about the sort of the place of the Academy Trust at the heart of their communities. And this is very much about that, isn't it? It's like, what does our local community need? And how can we, particularly in areas that are struggling, how can the education world, how can the Academy Trust sector help to support a burgeoning new economy in those regions by giving them children and young people with this, well, young people with the skills that can enable development of other sort of renewable energy technologies, etc., in those areas?
Yeah, I think it's important that CEOs see themselves, and I know that that was a theme on the 2019 conference I attended. I think it was the theme that came out this year as well. But
Yes.
this issue around the CEO being the sort of civic leader, You know, this is actually about the CEO really reaching out and going much further than they used to in terms of engaging with businesses. And that's, and I have to say, I think that this is particularly true for those who are leading in the primary phase. You know, that actually I think it's very, very important that we make sure that young people have got a curriculum that's going to enable them to be excited by the opportunities that are presented at the secondary phase, but also give them a little bit of an insight as to, you know, the application of some of the work they're doing in primary. And I know there's a lot of work going on, I think it's at Primary Futures and whatever, to try and connect business with with schools. But actually, there's a lot more that individual CEOs can do to actually make sure that they're connecting with their local business community and playing, you know, and making sure that everybody knows the great work that's going on in those trusts, you know? I mean, I think the other thing was for me, every time we get onto this, it always makes me feel about, because I'm a real fan of digital, and you were talking about agile and being creative. But I think, you know, the issue for me is that, you know, we really do need to embrace digital education, and not just the technical skills, the knowledge of that, but actually the way that digital businesses work, and the importance of things like presentation skills and the ability to show leadership within a team, and also to sort of stand up for a position, but be open to the views of others. You know, so I think sometimes these are things that are occasionally forgotten about, because they're not things in many subjects that you would examine, but actually they're pretty critical for a success in sort of in the future, particularly around digital businesses. I mean, one of the things that I was struck by, this is the third point really, because it links into digital, was cybersecurity. You know, I was approached recently by a couple of researchers from Liverpool University, because they were concerned about a lack of awareness within businesses and in the education sector of the risks associated with cybersecurity. And I've connected them with Forum Strategy, and I know that they're coming to discuss the work that they do to colleagues on the 13th of December between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. And I believe they're going to be joined virtually by a colleague who's going to join us from South America, who's a world expert on this issue. I think the interesting thing for me is that I think for some people, this is an issue that you hope won't hit you, you know, and actually when it goes wrong, and I think we've had a couple of high profile trusts, one of which is a very large multi-academy trust, when that security is breached, the impact is enormous. And just on a personal level, and perhaps you shouldn't mention this, but my daughter and her husband, they were remortgaging, and there was a cybersecurity attack on a legal firm in Leicestershire, and that delayed for nearly 2 weeks the approval of that mortgage release, you know, the funding related to it. So, you know, these things, you know, it's not as if people involved in hacking and whatever, then they don't give you any warning. They don't care who you are, you know. So in a way, I think it's important that this area of cybersecurity is one that, you know, trusts actually get to grips with and understand where the risks are coming from. So I'd really urge everybody, if they could, to come along and try and raise their awareness. So, yeah, so we've done quite a bit there, haven't we, in terms of cybersecurity. We've flown through how the curriculum needs to be adapted to meet local needs. And also we've covered the climate change conference in Glasgow. That's not bad for the first 15 minutes. So let's look a little bit for looking forward now. So I mean, I think we're going to talk about mental health support teams now, aren't we?
We are, yes. I mean, I think, you know, rightly so, and also brought into even sharper focus during the last sort of 18 months or so, has been the sort of the need for mental health support for pupils and staff. The rollout of the mental health support teams has been a sort of an initiative driven by the NHS, and it's involving sort of skilled, it's kind of involving this appointment of skilled mental health practitioners who'll be allocated to secondary schools in a particular area, with the intention that sort of both primary and secondary schools link into these. and special schools as well. So there'll be sort of, I think the idea of this is for those, because we know we acknowledge that teachers don't have these skills yet. Mm. They don't have these areas of expertise. And they are really kind of struggling to provide the support and to provide the signposting. I mean, obviously they've stepped up to the plate in sort of recent months. But I think the idea of sort of the mental health and well-being in schools sort of initiatives, there's a range of them, of which mental health support teams is one element, is really trying to kind of again bring to the fore and not have it as an add-on, make it sort of like bring it to the core of the thinking in schools and trusts. And the idea of that program is to well, it's a pilot at the moment, it'll be in certain areas, but sort of look to have a sort of central person who's a central repository of where to signpost people to. Obviously the difficulty with that is that we also know on the other side of the fence is the fact that the CAMHS services are really struggling. The referral services for children and young people's mental health are really struggling. So it will be very interesting how this plays out. In the spirit of the podcast, I don't want to be pessimistic about it, being optimistic and upbeat, but I think it will be very interesting. Because I think that schools and trusts have been doing their very best on trying to get this support and coming up quite often against a brick wall at no fault of local authority provision at all, but just simply resource-based issues. But I think it's definitely one to watch. It's good that it's mental health and well-being is being brought to the fore, and it's you know, it's been accelerated by the pandemic and concerns over that. And I think that we also need to think about this is about supporting mental health and early intervention for mental ill health. I think we often conflate when we talk about mental health, we automatically think we're talking about mental ill health. Yes. And we're not. We're talking about it in a positive light, embracing it and enabling mental good health, whilst trying our best to intervene as early as possible when there are issues around mental ill health for both staff and pupils.
Yeah, it's interesting because I do some work in a couple of local authorities in the north, and one in particular, I got sight of the full range of mental health support that was provided both by, you know, the state, shall I say, the third sector and what have you. So a lot of it I was completely unaware of. So I think these colleagues that are going to be placed as sort of mental health leads from these mental health support teams, I think they're pretty critical in terms of opening up the availability, making schools and staff within them more aware of what is available locally, so that actually we can seek that sort of support before we have to get into, you know, this sort of more formal element of referral. So in effect, it's trying to ensure that we're engaging, you know, at an early stage with the people that have the expertise, which I think is at times difficult to identify, because it seems sort of quite complex in terms of trying to work out where I go with this particular issue. So hopefully that will, you know, that will go some way to sort of making the position feel a little bit more comfortable, at least for schools to be able to manage the needs. I mean, I was really pleased with the fact that you said there, Sarah, that, you know, in a way this is an ethos and culture issue. You know, this actually gets to the heart of, you know, what our school's going to be about. You know, so it's being, you know, treating, you know, the staff and the pupils, the entire community, and valuing them and caring for them. You know, it gets really to the heart of why we're doing it. So I think that there's a lot that, you know, we can get from all of this. So I hope that those support teams, that initiative is successful. I think they're in 50 local authorities, not in all 150 or whatever it is. So So hope, and the intention is that they will roll out to more in the next few waves as they take place. So, I mean, hey, it's been an interesting week in politics. So
yes.
No, we're not going to be too political, but there's been a lot of media coverage, isn't there, about MPs and second jobs and stuff. And the issue for me was really around just the openness and transparency. I keep referring back to, and if you've heard me speak at a presentation, I'm including everyone, so I'm sorry if I'm boring you all by saying it again. But I became very interested in why some major businesses failed. And that's RBS or Lehman Brothers or whatever, Enron, whatever you want to call it. And those are the large companies. You know, there are, smaller businesses that fail for quite similar reasons. So I became quite interested in the work of Dr. Marianne Jennings, who produced a research, it was a PhD, which turned into a book, which looked at the seven signs of ethical collapse. And I every time I come on to something like this, it's a really small book. It's readily available from Amazon and other good booksellers. But actually, it's a very, very readable book. And for me, what I found it really interesting was looking forward, which is what we're trying to do here, is some of the risks that there are in terms of openness and transparency. You know, she highlights fairly small businesses that have failed because of one of the two or three of those ethical signs not being, they're there, and people were not aware of them, or if they were aware of them, were not open to challenging them or doing something about it. So I think the thing for me was that if it's well worth looking on YouTube for Marianne Jennings and seeing what she's got to say, because I think that there is something here about trust being as open as they can be, to the people that they're serving. And so I think one thing I was particularly proud of as a CEO was we had like an annual general meeting, and so where staff could present to the board, they could pose a question. It was a bit like a shareholders meeting, to be honest. But we put that onto YouTube Live, and actually I think that's the sort of thing where the board need to ensure that they listen, they hear directly from, from the people that they're serving. And so that could be staff. We didn't allow, at that stage, we didn't allow children and young people to be present, but we were open to receiving questions from them. And so we could, in a way, we tried to ensure that questions were managed so that they could be collated, and we always ensure that they weren't personal. So it's more about the broad direction of the trust. So I think in the sense of a spirit of openness and transparency, which is I think where we were going with the MPs, I think that's something that the sector can do more to ensure that the board hear directly from those that are actually receiving delivering the service that they're offering. So hey, I think there's a few events coming up over the next few weeks. I don't know if you want to try and summarise those, Sarah.
Yes, thank you, Frank. Yes, we've got a few coming up. We've got obviously this week we've got the next CEO network meeting, which are always a great source of professional development for colleagues, a great networking opportunity, a great opportunity to hear from what colleagues in other sectors. As you know, Frank, we've always been people in from other sectors to
give us. Strategy is really good at that. I mean, I know that you've had the CEO from the co-op there. I was part of that one, but I've also looked at the other CEO program, the CEO program you have, where you do invite people from outside the sector. Mm. It's so relevant, isn't it?
Yeah.
The same issues.
Yes, it is. And I think that's the thing, to challenge thinking, but to also feel, like actually there's other people in other sectors. There are some things that are specific to education, but actually when you get to the level of CEO, you very often find that you are dealing with the same types of issues as colleagues, particularly in the public sector, but also sort of beyond in the private sector and third sector as well. So that's something to look forward to. We've got quite a bit going on there, including input from Mark Gallagher, who was the former F1 chief executive. We've got inputs on the net zero agenda, and just referring back to what we'll be talking about at the top of the piece, and the implications for CEOs and the telecom trusts going forward. And then we've got, so looking slightly further ahead, we've got another a members' breakfast briefing on the 8th of December, which is specifically for colleagues, CEOs of academy trusts in the north of England. We're getting an update from yourself, Frank, on the Northern Powerhouse Partnership, and from the partnership's director, Henri Murison.
Yeah, Henry is his name.
Henry, so, is yeah, it?
Well, I,
it's or went all French, sorry.
No, but the thing is that it's really topical today, because we're recording it today and we're 2 days away from the government's announcement on HS2, which I know the Northern Powerhouse Partnership is a lot more than just HS2, I must tell you that. But obviously, yeah, this is an important element. Henry will be, either be very up or quite disappointed, however it is. But actually, one of the key things, if it is disappointment, it'd be interesting to tease out from him, you know, how he's coped with this disappointment, you know, because this is a significant challenge for him. But I suspect, knowing him, he'll be up ready for the fight next time. He's not going to give up on this one, I don't think. So,
oh, no.
Anyway.
And then just looking a little bit further ahead, and you mentioned this earlier on in the podcast, Frank, on the December the 13th, the members masterclass that we're holding and that you're hosting with colleagues from Sistel who will be talking about cybersecurity and bringing in their perspectives on what Academy Trust CEOs and their teams need to be aware of and need to be really addressing quite urgently in this area. So I think that's, like you say, we'll plug that one, because that's something that I think that with, you know, there were quite a few, not just high profile, but quite a few sort of cyber attacks during the pandemic. I think trusts being seen as easy targets, really. And like you say, the implications were huge. And particularly for the children, you know, the implications for learning often were huge in that sense. So I think that, in a sense, it's been brought into sharp focus at that time, but maybe perhaps fallen off the,
I was thinking there, Sarah, what would happen if a cyber attack occurred the day before the payday?
Mm. Yeah.
So, you know, you've got all your staff members. I'm sure some of them would be sympathetic to the fact that the money didn't arrive on the day, but for some it would be absolutely critical, wouldn't it?
Mm,
so
yes,
little things where you think, I wonder what we would do. And no doubt there is a backup plan, but actually, if that is a total cyber breakdown, you know, a total your security has been breached, then actually, you know, that puts into stark focus the, you know, the impact and the negative impact of that on you as an individual, as a CEO, but also the damage it would do with regard to, you know, the reputation and the goodwill that you'd lose through it.
Absolutely. And of course, as well, as with so many things in society, would have the most impact on the lowest paid.
Yes.
Probably those that are sort of living month to month and rely on knowing that payday is coming on a certain day every month, because then the bills are going out. So, sort of really critical. So I think that that's going to be very interesting to hear the colleagues' perspective from Sistel on sort of awareness and what needs to happen. And that'll be brilliant. So I think that's probably it from the updates.
Well, that's just, I think, just over 30 minutes or so. And it's time to wrap the podcast up. How do you feel it's gone for you, Sarah?
I think it's gone okay, but let's wait to hear from colleagues and see what they think.
Well, I've enjoyed it, and I hope those that are listening have as well. Don't forget to let us have your thoughts on the podcast and how we might be able to improve it. I suspect you will have Sarah's email, so it's probably best if you want to drop a comment or two, if you direct them to Sarah's email at Forum Strategy. We're very keen to see whether or not you've enjoyed it, and we want to know how we can improve it. So all being well, There will be a second podcast, and that should be shortly before Christmas. So until then, stay safe, and I hope everything works out well for you with your plans over the next 3 or 4 weeks. So it's goodbye from Frank, and it's goodbye from
Sarah. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you.